Thank you. Hello, everyone, and thank you for bearing with us. Although it's great to hear so many friendly voices and overhear so many good conversations, because that's absolutely what we want to facilitate here today. So it's good you've already got that going. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming. And I also have to say that, you know, this panel is only as strong as the conversation it facilitates both here and beyond this room in your own practices and in your own lives and institutions. But I would like to acknowledge that the theme of this panel comes from the fact that I know you all to be doing a lot of this work in your own lives already. And I also am very grateful that over the past few days, this panel has not by any means existed as a standalone effort. A lot of the issues we've been talking about, some by incredibly eloquent speakers, have addressed some of the things that we'd like to continue talking about today. So thank you all for that and for participating in that. So my name is Brooke Palmieri, and the library has formed the sort of enduring utopian model for me in my life. It's been a place where I've found a warm welcome, and the memory of that warm welcome is something I've drawn upon in other spaces where I've been less welcome. And so that's why I'm very pleased to be here today with an association of people who have contributed to that as well. The canon is an idea that some texts are more valuable than others, but I do think it's a concept that allows us to come together and question collectively what value is and how value might be stretched to accommodate new meanings or new possibilities or subverted to welcome in new people. So to that end, today I've got four amazing speakers, and I'll be contributing my bit at the end. First, we'll hear from Carla, and then Shannon, and then Beatrice and Jesse. Each of them will tell you a little bit about their institutions and the work that they've been doing to address the significance of the canon as a place for rallying people together and giving some common ground with which to question the self-same act, you know, in one fell swoop question, as well as invite and welcome in. So thank you very much. Without further ado, Carla.
Carla Nelson.
I'm just going to begin, and then the slides will hopefully follow.
It really wouldn't be a conference if there wasn't technical difficulties. Let's just acknowledge that, too.
And, you know, the slides are just okay. my slides. Columbia College, the Ivy League college that is part of the larger entity Columbia University, is about to celebrate the centenary of its core curriculum, a series of courses required of all undergraduates at the college. How's that volume? Is everyone hearing it? All right. Great, I will do that. Okay. Hopefully without turning anything off. The curriculum began with versions of two courses, Literature, Humanities, and Contemporary Civilizations, all right. Which are now year-long courses, which most students take over their first and second years. 80 to 90 sections of each course are taught each year by graduate students, postdocs, and junior and senior faculty from across the humanities. We do quite a bit of instruction support for the core curriculum within the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. I've been running 20 to 30 Lit Hum visits per year, and other colleagues in the RBML conduct many sessions for contemporary civilizations and music and art humanities. So, slide with a sample syllabus, or this last year's syllabus for the Literature Humanities course.
We're getting there.
If you look at the university archives, you will find that the stated motivations for creating these courses almost 100 years ago were a desire to expose students with an honors-level interest in the humanities to texts that would prepare them for graduate work, compensation for the removal of Greek and Latin from the Columbia College curriculum by reading Greek and Latin classics in translation, and a desire after World War I to prepare students to think humanistically about peace and conflict studies. So for Lit Hum and CC, that is... that was the original determination for the selection of many of the texts. The core's goals had changed over time, but always remained interested in using the past to think about the present, and it is one of the very few places on the campus to affirm the value of the humanities. The core also has, you know, ideas about what it's doing. This is from their website. They have a lot of text, but this is just a sample. Not only academically rigorous, but also personally transformative for students, the core seminar thrives on oral debate of the most difficult questions of human experience. The habits of mind developed in the core cultivate a critical and creative intellectual capacity that students employ long after college in the pursuit of and fulfillment of meaningful lives. So yeah, lofty goals. Many see the curriculum as itself conservative. It is a great books or Western Civ survey, but it is also a place where the college affirms the value of diversity. This is also from the core website. The core classroom is also the place where the college realizes most vividly the value of its diversity. In the core classroom, students meet face-to-face and listen to each other. Because core conversations are about human questions of the deepest order, they serve as vehicles for individuals from sometimes starkly different backgrounds to experience what it means to see the world through someone else's eyes. So this is an assertion from within the Center for the Core that it's not necessarily the choice of text, but the way that conversation happens around them, which is a place where it becomes a place where the campus has committed to diversity, which is possibly problematic. We can talk about that. The Center for the Core asserts, let's say, there is also, though, a debate about the contents. Each year, the instructors debate whether the syllabus should remain the same, and over the years, some changes have been made. Reports back from the meeting that the faculty go to debate about the syllabus show that every department is interested in sending like what they refer to as a heavy hitter onto the syllabus. So there's a real bias towards like large, ambitious novels. People don't want to send in a lyric poet or a playwright, unless it's Shakespeare, or an essayist, unless it's Montaigne. So there is that is one of the factors that actually is a conservative force within the syllabus formation. There is also a desire to teach texts that refer back to earlier works and works that have been often adapted, cited, and translated so that with histories of ongoing relevance. When I began at Columbia, both Lit Hum and CC, Contemporary Civilizations, ended with Virginia Woolf. Like, that's as far as they could imagine. And this past year was the first where the final text on the syllabus for Literature Humanities was Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. We don't have any. However, especially since the social movements of the 1960s, there have been challenges to the core curriculum for the from the students. They periodically organize to protest or to submit formal petitions to diversify the authors on the syllabus.
It's coming.
On the right, a banner drop by Barnard students. That was part of the 1968 protests on the Columbia campus. Shows. I'm going to describe this. It's part of the 1968 protests on the Columbia campus. Barnard students did a banner drop on Butler Library. Butler Library is the main humanities library on campus, and it's emblazoned with the name of classical authors, very big, and then slightly smaller American authors, all male. So, thank you. Yay! Yay. Nice work. All right, so now that we have the slides, I'm not sure you can make it on the slide on the right, but the names on the building are mostly Greek authors that you can see, and then above on the banner drop, it's Sappho, Marie de France, Christine de Pizan, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, Bronte, Dickinson, Wolfe. So now some of those authors have made it onto the syllabus, but at the time there were no women on either of the syllabuses, and actually no women on campus. The first woman to be added to the syllabus was Jane Austen in 1985, 2 years after women were admitted to Columbia College. Okay, and on the left, there's a page or two pages of a handout. There's a handout advocating the decolonization of the Columbia campus, including the removal of statues and the recognition of land taken from Native peoples. This pamphlet was distributed at a protest action in April of this year, itself part of a week-long strike organized by the Graduate Student Union at Columbia, which university administration is not recognizing. You will see, or I will read, that the demand is to decolonize the curricula by centralizing and privileging the voices and knowledge of marginalized people. And there are many people who would like to see this, but not all of the instructors who teach these core classes do so in self-reflective and self-conscious ways. And in the library, we have to conduct our one-off sessions within the dynamics already established in those seminars and can only anticipate what those dynamics will be so much. The instructors and their students, based on prior knowledge and word of mouth, have expectations about what they're going to see in these visits to special collections, And often they want to see the rare book equivalents of heavy hitters, right? So they want to see the Gutenberg Bible fragment, and they want to see a Shakespeare folio, or a 1517 Aldine Homer with annotations by Philip Melanchthon. You know, they want to see the awesome stuff. And we have a collection that is both broad and deep, and has been a privilege to teach from it. I do have a different set of books that I bring out if the instructors want students to be able to touch and browse, but that is a topic for another session. Over the past many years of doing these rare book sessions for literature humanities, I've come up with some techniques to introduce the students to the history of the book in ways that I can anticipate connect to discussions they've been having about the text. So most classes spend a fair amount of time on the tole lege, or pick up and read scene from Augustine's Confessions. And so you can say, what is this object that Augustine picks up as a way to talk about the codex as a format? But I want to do in my remaining time is emphasize the difference between two gestures, inclusion and disruption, expanding the canon or challenging the logics of canon formation. Can you advance? Thank you. This slide shows a 13th century manuscript Bible on the left, and one of our noble fragments of the Gutenberg Bible on the right. It's great to bring out these two because they show continuities in page layout across manuscript and early print. You can ask the students questions that they don't need background knowledge to answer, such as what do you think was produced by hand or machine in each of these books? How can you tell? How might we account for similarities in layout over hundreds of miles and hundreds of years? Even when talking about the popular understanding of Gutenberg as the person who, quote, invented printing, students educated in China or Korea often point out that xylographic printing with movable type was in use in Asia centuries before Gutenberg's invention. So we hone in on just what exactly Gutenberg invented. Or even better, I can bring out a book produced in Asia with wood type. For the past few years, I have been bringing out an Amharic Bible gifted to Columbia by Haile Selassie in 1961. It is not the only African production on the table, because there are often also papyrus fragments, but it is the only African book printed in an African language in the 20th century. I think it's very important to bring out, especially Asian texts, not only is from the distant past, right, to actually show more contemporary productions from Asia and Africa. The book also allows us to talk about dedication copies, or more specifically about the long history of gift books. What was Haile Selassie signaling as Emperor of Ethiopia by producing and donating the first printed Amharic Bibles and donating them to universities in the United States? And that's a productive conversation, and that pushes out from the conversation you might have about the Bible if you only bring out Catholic Bibles or Bibles produced in Europe. But I want to talk about a different gesture. This next slide, which is shown a page from a manuscript version. It's all good. From the 1001 Nights, and then also a page spread from the Decameron. I've recently been working with a whole series, like a cluster hire of junior faculty who work on Arabic, who've been interested in bringing out the suppression of Arabic text in the Westward March of Progress, or Translatio Studii et Imperii, that the spring semester of the Literature Humanities syllabus charts. So the slide we didn't see that showed that syllabus shows that it moves from the Aeneid to now Song of Solomon, and goes from like the Latin epic to Italian epic. What are the medieval? I will get to that. That comes in. When I look at the spring semester syllabus, I do see the connections from Virgil to Dante to Don Quixote, but I see in between those texts Kalila wa Dimna, Sendebad, and Alf Laila wa Laila, Semitic tale collections that are the sources for stories in European collections such as the Decameron, and also the model for organizing a series of shorter narratives within a narrative frame, and the use of page layout and paratext to organize the reading of these complex narratives. These narratives, and also these books, came from the Eastern Mediterranean through Frederick II's court in Sicily, and through Al-Andalus, the series of Islamic caliphates and kingships in Iberia, and are a crucial way to understand the development of late medieval European vernacular literature. To talk about these suppressed Arabic texts is not to get into subdisciplinary weeds. These courses are intentionally taught not in a non-disciplinary way, but to show that an entire chapter of European intellectual and literary history has been miswritten, that the Middle Ages are rendered the Dark Ages to obscure a period when Islamic empires dominated the Mediterranean and produced the texts and translations that the so-called Renaissance takes credit for recovering. Almost all of us will have work to do that is somehow organized by the idea of canon. The wedge that we feel like we can make will depend on the relationships that we establish and the training and perspective that we bring to a given set of canonical texts. What I'm hoping to point out here is that we can always look to make a more incisive and disruptive intervention. When you teach that canon formation always proceeds through intentional omissions and silences, rather than, quote, making room at the table, you teach a different lesson, one that highlights the power dynamics of representation and exclusion. Doing so from within the canon both troubles and assuages the nagging discomfort that many of the students feel about the elitist variety of cultural literacy promised by the core curriculum at Columbia College. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Carla, especially for both disrupting and being pretty consistently disrupted. Sorry, and sorry, audience folk. So next up we have Shannon Supple. The gentleman who helped set this up said, do not touch the computer, but I'm going to touch the computer to try to bring up Shannon's PowerPoint presentation.
I can also speak without my slides, but the first slide is really important to me, and you'll see why in a minute for those of you who like the musical Hamilton.
Oh, yeah.
That title was courtesy of Megan Hahn Fraser. I don't know if she's in the audience. Thank you, Megan. Can you hear me okay in the back? Okay, I'm a little shorter than everybody else. I'm kind of bringing it down. I'm at Smith College, and we are an undergraduate institution, and a faculty member and I cooked up a project. So the project is incorporating students into collection building and acquisitions decision making. Smith College English professor Andrea Stone and I worked together to craft a class assignment for a semester-long course in which students select materials for inclusion in and to be purchased by special collections at Smith. So my faculty partner is Associate Professor of English Language and Literature, Andrea Stone. She teaches literatures of the African diaspora from the 18th century to the present, with a focus on the United States, Canada, and the Caribbean. So for some context, Smith College Special Collections, our mission is, I'm going to quote this, as a steward of historical materials of enduring value, Smith College Special Collections fosters inquiry, critical thinking, and knowledge building through an active engagement with the past and a focus on the future. So our challenge in the part of Special Collections that I oversee, which is known as the Mortimer Rare Book Collection, is that we have a rich and robust collection of material texts. And they are dominated by traditionally represented voices, especially those of privileged white people in Western cultural contexts. So that's our context. And what we want to do is create an environment and a project in which the students get something out of it, and we in Special Collections get something out of it too. So the goals for the students in this project, and I guess I'll tell you a little bit more about the project later. Sorry about that. Learn what is and is not in Special Collections. Learn how to search for material evidence in Special Collections. Learn how to search for material evidence on sale in the marketplace, learn about artifactual value beyond the text, and identify complexities of collection building, including crafting a historical record, privileging some knowledge over others, resource limitations, and shifts in a live marketplace. Next slide, please. The goals for Special Collections in this project are to connect materials acquired directly to the college curriculum, incorporating many minds in considering what we include in our tiny quarter of the historical record, activate expertise of faculty members and students as they learn about specific subjects, and make more representative of our lives the material evidence of voices and experiences we collect. So the classes involved, we had a class work on this project in the fall and then a different class in the spring. So for additional context, The class in the fall was Literatures of the Black Atlantic, and it's a lecture-based class, but it's Smith, so it's a small lecture. 19 students with varied majors and years of being at Smith. And that class focuses on Literatures of the Black Atlantic and the development of Black literacy and intellectual history from the 18th to the 21st century. The second class just took place in the spring. It was a seminar class of 12 students, mostly English majors and juniors and seniors, so sort of at the end of their tenure at Smith. And that class explored various publications produced by people of the of African descent in the United States, Canada, and England. Sermons, conversion narratives, criminal confessions, fugitive slave narratives, and black press materials. Next slide, please. Thank you. So, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the process of the project now. So the students visited special collections two times, one with an overview. It was a general overview visit of what we have, giving them an introduction to this project. And then they later came in for an in-depth research project with materials that we currently house. So we were giving them the sort of experience of being researchers in the collection. And then they could begin asking questions and seeing what we have there. But the introductory visit included me giving them an overview of how to locate what we have in the collections already, how to do some searching in that live marketplace that I was talking about. And here I want to give a shout out to Between the Covers, because they send me about 20 to 30 catalogs of their African Americana catalogs that I can hand out to the students. And so even though I'm sharing with them what how I can search and how I can search in online databases and across different booksellers what they have available, their stock, there's sort of meaning in the students having this sort of paper catalog. Just as we all know, there's meaning in the students connecting to the materiality of the materials that we have in special collections, and that has meaning for them, and that's important for them to engage with in that sense too. So thank you to Tom and his team. I also provide the students with that training, with guidance. They can come talk to me at any time. They can talk to the faculty member. And I give them a budget. I gave them $5,000. That was an arbitrary number. We were just, let's see what happens if we give them $5,000. So the proposals were mostly crafted in pairs. And then they were prepared and submitted to the entire class. So the students actually worked toward creating a proposal to advocate for something we don't already have in special collections coming in. So all the students then review the proposals and provide feedback to each other with queries about the materials that they were providing. So they look at each other's proposals, offer suggestions, questions. Then the students review that feedback received from others, and then do additional research on those questions. And it was funny because when they came together as a council, I asked them, so did any of you actually contact the booksellers? And they said no. They didn't think they could do that because they're used to this sort of being in a glass space and not being in a sort of live, active project where something's really happening. It's sort of, this is actually really happening. So you could actually go to the bookseller and ask them questions. So I suggested in the future they could do that, and then that's a learning point that I had in the future. I need to let them know that they can go and talk to the booksellers to ask questions. On the left is a photo of the students presenting their proposals to the class, they're sharing their research responses to each other's queries, discussing the value of the material evidence they propose. Then the students vote on which items they want to acquire within the budget. Then I purchase the items selected by the students. In a few cases, items were already sold. It was a live marketplace. So I could have reached out to the booksellers and said, you know, let's hold this for now. But, you know, I don't know what they're proposing at the time. So, and I also want them to have that real experience of thinking about the live marketplace of materiality. So something might be gone by the time we get to it. But then something else arrives, right? Or format might be inappropriate. We had a suggestion for a painting, and I realized I was not clear to them in what we are prepared to steward. So painting didn't work. So I'm learning as I go with this project. So we purchased and got the materials in the spring semester. It was great. The materials arrived the last day of class. So the students were actually able to come over to Special Collections and take a look. And so that's what you're seeing on the in the middle and on the right. We had some hams in the group. They were really excited. They just talked about how wonderful it was to be part of this project. So they learned so much, and they said it was so much more real when they actually saw the materials. So even this through this whole process, it was this sort of, you know, vague possibility, and then it became this real concrete thing when they saw the materials come in. Next slide, please. So I just took a picture of the books here to tantalize you, and I won't go into too much about what they are, but the books from the first semester are here, the books from the second semester are there, and it's just been a lot of fun. I can tell you more about what we got at another time, but this isn't about the materials at the moment, it's about the people. So, lessons learned and open questions. Clear delineation of formats we are equipped to steward. So archival documents, manuscript codices, printed books, graphic arts, ephemera, yes. Painting, sculpture, no. What if materials proposed go over budget? I told them to make a case because it was an arbitrary amount that I gave them, the $5,000. I said, I will make the ultimate decision in consultation with our director of special collections of how much money we can give to this project. But if they found something great that's over budget, do it. Just make the case to me, and we will do it. We will make it happen. And, you know, it's funny because that didn't happen these two times, but we're going to keep doing this, and it's going to happen. And I'm so excited for them to make that passionate case to me about why we should bring in this thing that happens to be more expensive. So this is one that's really important to me, and I think I really need to be clear about whose history is this. There are problems inherent in predominantly white women making these decisions. I'm a white woman. The faculty member is a white woman. A lot of the students are white women or other gender minorities. And we do have women of color in that class, but most of us are white and we're making these decisions. And this is about black print culture and the African diaspora. So this is inherently problematic. And I do want to interrogate that more, and I'd love to get your thoughts about that. The other big question I have is scalability. So what if we invited more faculty and classes to do this, and how scalable is it? I have a faculty member that teaches Asian American literature, and I really want to work on this with him. But then I think, okay, I'm doing these two projects with these two different faculty members, and there's so many other potential partners out there that we can do this with, and it could eventually get to sort of beyond what I could handle. But it's so important, and I'm so delighted by it, to have all of these voices coming together to think about what we're creating in this historical record that we're crafting in this tiny little corner of history. I really think Athena Jackson has said this before, and many other people have as well, that we need more than one mind thinking through what we're collecting. And I might be the sort of point person, the lead steward for the Mortimer Rare Book Collection at Smith College, but I want our faculty and our students and our staff to be thinking about what we're collecting and making decisions around that too. So that's really important to me. So there's more to do, there's more to learn. And I look forward to your questions and your feedback and your suggestions. I'm also presenting this today to encourage those of you who are able to try this at your home institutions to give it a go. Even if you don't have access to the actual funds, you can probably craft a situation in which you're doing a sort of a faux version of this if you can't actually bring them in yourself. But it's so meaningful to the students, and they end up learning these sort of different ways of thinking about the collections that we steward, and also thinking sort of we're more transparent about what we're doing, and we're stewardship in our collecting as well. So I think it's a great project, and I look forward to continuing to improve. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Shannon. So we've moved from repositioning the canon in Carla's place, in Carla's instance and examples, to reconsidering who is involved in the process of a kind of canon formation, and we're going to kind of continue that discussion with Beatrice's presentation about inviting and collaborating with artists in the collection. Thank you.
So you can move to the next slide. Okay. Thank you. The University of Miami has recently articulated a new vision for a hemispheric university that has deepened the emphasis on regional studies in the Caribbean and Latin America. Concrete steps towards that goal include the publication of special country reports, such as Cuba and the Caribbean, which highlights the scholarly work of faculty and researchers. Our latest project at the Cuban Heritage Collection, where I work, involved a collaboration with the UN President's Office, Communications Office, faculty, librarians, from the distinctive collections to curate an exhibit linked to the launch of the Cuba and the Caribbean Special Report. The Cuban Heritage Collection was established in the early 1960s by Cuban emigre librarians. The Cuban Heritage Collection is both a distinctive collection and community archives. To refer to the work of French historian Pierre Nora, the repository can be seen as both a site of memory, lieu de mémoire, and realms of memory, milieu de mémoire. Within the context of an immigrant community, the collection as space is repeatedly chosen as a site of significant cultural events because it preserves evidence of stories left behind. Inspired by the work of Diane Taylor on hemispheric and performance studies, the Cuban Heritage Collection can be seen within realms of memory or milieu. It serves as a space for creative expression and the ongoing evolution of memory making with activities such as oral histories, community events, and performances that incorporate culture beyond the written word and decenters textual knowledge as primary episteme or way of knowing. It is against such a background that it was deemed appropriate that the Cuba and the Caribbean Special Report should be released in the Cuban Heritage Collection. The curators decided to try something new by inviting Cuban artist Leandro Soto to be part of the curatorial team after seeing his work, which emerged aesthetic concepts of Cuba in relation to other parts of the Caribbean. We wondered if his recent comparative work completed in the English Caribbean, specifically in Barbados, could provide a unifying theme for the exhibit, even if it was a departure from what we had done before and involved changing the face of an established space in the public imaginary. Leandro Soto was born in Cuba and has been involved in the art world for 40 years. His training includes a BA in painting and engraving and an MA in scenic arts, scenography, and costume design. He has taken part in numerous group exhibitions and solo shows in museums, art galleries, and alternative spaces throughout the world. Mr. Soto co-curated the exhibit with the CHC Distinctive Collections librarians and staff. His creative work permeates and thematically unifies the narrative with images of the sea, geography, and Caribbean deities. The archival space became a reimagined seascape where fragments of culture and communication were located within a fluid, ever-changing ocean that connected Caribbean nations. Visitors to the exhibit were purposely placed in a set, and short of being able to experience this exhibit, I would like to convey the artist's intent by sharing his exhibit statement. So I quote Leandro, This exhibition focuses on the imposing presence of the Caribbean Sea for all the countries that are surrounded by it or those that border its waters. As a starting point, I have used my scenography sketches for a staging title, Siete Tonalidades de Azul, Seven Tonalities of Blue, a theatrical performance presented at the University of the West Indies in Barbados. Now housed at the University of Miami, the sketches are part of the Cuban Heritage Collection's permanent collection. The number seven in the title refers to Yemayat, the goddess of the sea, queen of salt waters. In the Yoruba religion, this Orisha represents the mother of life, creator of all living things, as well as goddess of profound knowledge and the wealth of the seas. Drawing from my experience in scenography, I have transformed the library's open and closed spaces into a seascape. With this installation, visitors are invited to appreciate the various aspects of the sea and interact with it. Anyone who comes to the library to study or do research will do so poetically, from the inside, immersed in it. To refer back to the artist's statement about the goddess of the sea, the central piece of the exhibit featured in this image is La Virgen de Regla, patron of Havana. Her church, known as Iglesia de la Virgen de Regla, overlooks Havana where slaves disembarked in the Bay of Regla. The figure is a syncretic encounter of the Catholic religion image of the Virgin Mary with the Yoruba religion Orisha image of Yemaya, goddess of the sea. This statue was decorated by Cuban anthropologist Lydia Cabrera and is part of her papers at the Cuban Heritage Collection. So just as our opening event was a collaboration for the release of the Cuba and the Caribbean Report, our closing event was a collaboration with faculty from UM School of Modern Languages, Dance, and Music. We organized a conversation between Professor Manzor, who specializes in theater performances, and artist Leandro Soto. The event concluded with a song and dance performance inspired by the exhibit by UM students and faculty from the music school. The Caribbean Fragments exhibit presented an additional opportunity to explore other forms of knowledge creation in the distinctive collections by merging theatrical components, archives, and performance. Our curatorial disruption included not only the insertion of an artist into the curatorial process, but also concluded with a physical dance performance combining both an intellectual and experiential or embodied encounter with the archives through the medium of art. There's one more. And I included this last slide as part of the closing event to convey our thanks, but also to reflect the complexity and the collaborative component of a project like this, and to illustrate all the expertise that is needed to plan something like that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Beatrice. And that brings up a really wonderful point that I think also came up in Shannon's talk about how texts relate to non-textual objects, something that we can definitely continue to talk about in the Q&A. But for now, we are happy to welcome Jesse Erickson to present.
actually really nervous about moving this right now.
Me too.
Okay, everybody can hear me. All right, happy solstice, everybody. Thanks, everyone, for coming and for bearing with us as we endure through these technical difficulties. It looks like everything's been worked out. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to jump right on in. So in full disclosure, I actually enjoy reading and studying and even deconstructing canonical literature. I've had a fondness for the classics of the Western literary tradition since the earliest days of my reading life. However, my experience as a person of color growing up in the United States has shaped my outlook in a way that has made me profoundly aware of the more problematic aspects of adhering to models of canonical thinking within the humanities. Sorry, there we go. At the core is the issue of textual myopia. Western canonicity, which styles itself as the arbiter of that which is tasteful, or rather that which is timeless in literature and worth multi-generational study, is premised upon exclusivity by definition. As a discursive modality, it privileges hermeneutical forms of reading over the casual and the consumptive. Not to disregard that there is a great deal in the canon that warrants the exalted status, but we cannot overlook the fact that Eurocentric and patriarchal overrepresentation within the canon is not coincidental, but the result of centuries of ethnocentrism and sexism operating at all levels within our systems of higher education. Now, before I applied to library school, I had already begun thinking about ways to challenge the myopia of canonical thinking. And so when I first entered the PhD program in information studies, I came in with the idea that ethnobibliography could be a form of academic bibliography that could begin to move beyond its past obsession with fine press printing and the early editions of Shakespearean text. Close to a decade ago, this was a time when such discussions within the bibliographical discourse were virtually absent. Now, I believed at that time that I had coined the term ethnobibliography. But as it turns out, bibliographer and former senior rare book cataloger at the Houghton Library, Hugh Amory, actually came up with the term in 1997, not long before he passed. So, what is ethnobibliography? As first envisioned by Amory, ethnobibliography was born from a combination of ethnohistory and descriptive bibliography. Amory sought to solve a riddle of a biblical fragment that was found in a Pequot medicine bundle. Now, the true genius of Amory's contribution was that he began to bridge the long-standing divide that separated textual criticism, which was concerned mostly with the physical makeup of a text, from the critical theorist and the formalist of new criticism, who were solely concerned with the contents of a text. Upon reading and rereading Amory's ethnobibliographical study, it occurred to me that he had disregarded an important element involved with the interplay of cultures, foregrounded in the object of his research. Essentially, he talked about the Pequot Nation as if it had totally disappeared, which it has not. Here I began to realize that my conceptualization for the method would be markedly different from how Amory had previously articulated it. That intellectual orientation first established in Amory's talk, however, which centered the book in relationship to a people, was a necessary intervention. It kept the method from migrating unnecessarily into anthropological scholarship in the form of bibliographic ethnography. Now, bibliographic ethnography looks at how people physically and socially interact with book objects from a cultural standpoint. The difference, again, lies in the orientation. Ethnobibliography is book-centered, whereas bibliographic ethnography is people-centered. Swearing on the Bible, for example, during induction ceremonies, using coffee table books as a status symbol, the social bonds formed in book clubs, and even the acts of inscribing and gifting books intergenerationally. These, I think, are all within the domain of bibliographic ethnography. It's a form of ethnography that really kind of got started in the early 2000s marked, for instance, with the publication of Janice Radway's A Feeling for Books, the book club of the month, Literary Taste and Middle Class Desire. But building on Amory's work, I outline a new vision for the method, keeping bibliographic materiality at its center, but with a new emphasis on social constructionism. Ethnobibliography, as I have come to develop it, has focused on how the material components and design elements of bibliographic objects, that is, books and ephemera, work to shape the ways in which we socially construct our ethnic and racial identities. As a method, it can be situated within the larger umbrella of critical bibliography, and it borders cultural graphology, a field of study with which it's exceedingly conversant. When I first started pointing out some of the connections between bibliographic materiality and racial and ethnic identity construction, my ideas were met with a healthy amount of skepticism. I found that scholars across a range of disciplines either uncritically accepted notion of bibliographic material objectivity or challenged the idea that race and ethnicity has anything to do with the materiality of these objects. However, when I began to point out the myriad of ways that the typography, the graphic design, the choice of materials, production techniques can both be informed by and are indicative of racial and ethnic identity construction, people started taking a second look at the objects they had long taken for granted. And what you see here is just a sort of a collage of book covers and frontispieces that I snapped from our library collections. So I found that ethnic typography is often the most prominent purveyor of this concept. Racial connotations, whether by design or by circumstance, are implicit in much of the textuality that we perceive on a daily basis. This can explain how we subconsciously associate Castle on Swash and its variants to black femininity in the same way that Tiffany script and its variants are tied to white femininity. And I'll point out here that the materiality is gendered as much as it is racialized. Further than that, observing how bibliographic design elements have been weaponized within efforts to oppress racial minorities through forced hegemony has left me open to the idea of developing a critical race bibliography. And bibliographic racism manifests itself in everything from the more patently offensive manufacture and use of the Jim Crow font, which I believe is now called Jim Dandy, but also to the more subtle ways that academic publications from developed nations impose their publishing standards on countries that can scarce afford a comparable university or scholarly printing infrastructure. But I'm not there yet. Now, moving into non-book textuality, and I apologize for skipping past the last slide, but I'm just going to power through these. What has interested me most in my current research is how one can employ ethnobibliography in the analysis of popular fiction, non-canonical literature, and non-book text. Now, non-book textuality has enjoyed relatively little scholarly attention within both conventional bibliographic and literary scholarship. Yet the paradigm has started to shift in recent years as we are beginning to understand how focusing on exclusively the canon prevents us from recognizing the depth and the richness of non-book textuality along with its alternative literacy practices. Now, this epistemological bubble that favors the printed codex over other textual formats was first pierced by D.F. McKenzie, who introduced the idea of non-book text at the close of the 20th century in his landmark study, Bibliography and the Sociology of Text. And later, G. Thomas Tenzel would argue for the efficacy of applying analytical bibliographic method in the study of non-book text in his 2005 essay, The Textual Criticism of Visual and Oral Works. Most recently, Johanna Drucker has advanced the term bibliographical alterities to describe the process of decentering the book from the book object, enabling us to conceptualize a non-object orientation to the bibliographic. But in all, we must acknowledge that non-book textual objects can still perform the quote-unquote book function, which is sort of similar to the Foucauldian concept of the author function. Resigning ourselves to canonical stagnation, moreover, renders invisible the true value of intellectually complex non-book textual artifacts that exist outside the scope of the manuscript and the printed codex. Now, this list includes, and by no means is this list comprehensive, divinatory and gaming non-book textual objects such as mahjong sets, oru ifa, and tarot decks, corporeal and textile non-book textual artifacts like text-based tattoos, punk culture bricolage, and African-American quilts, quasi-transient and static urban non-book textual objects like graffiti, skateboards, Japanese manhole covers, textuality in the visual arts like